Session number 21623, Reel 1.
Bob Stone, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Torquay.
Which year was this?
In 1929.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Torquay?
Yes, I attended Torquay Grammar School, leaving at the age of 16, when I joined the Navy as a boy seaman.
That must have been in 45 then?
September 1945.
So you spent the war years in Torquay?
All the war years in Torquay, yes.
You remember the Second World War?
Yes, vividly.
What memories have you got personally?
I used to keep a large map. I always remember I used to keep a large map on the wall, mainly concerned with the desert. With the desert campaign, where I used to move these flags around. But I've always been interested in the Navy, and anything that happened within the Navy, I was always interested in.
Did the war affect you at all in Torquay?
We used to have what they used to call tip-and-run raids. We never had any heavy bombing. It seemed mainly that the planes would come in from the continent, drop their bombs and just go off again. But I joined the Sea Cadets in Torquay. And once again, that was through my interest in the Navy, of course.
Where did the bombs fall in Torquay?
One of the worst bombs was on a church during a Sunday school. I forget how many children were killed, quite a lot. But another one, there used to be a big hotel in Torquay, the Palace Hotel, and it used to cater. It was taken over by the RAF during the war to treat the RAF wounded, mainly pilots. And that used to be, there was no doubt the Germans knew it, and that was very often a target for the Germans.
Was it damaged?
Oh yes, yes, and casualties of course. They seemed to be able to pick it out. In the main, there was just bombs dropped here and there in Torquay itself. But from Torquay we could see the fires from Exeter when the Exeter had their blitz, but Exeter and Plymouth had it worse, of course. We had one bomb dropped just across the road from where I lived, and that was just across the road, took down six houses with I forget how many were killed, but once again they reckon that was a plane that had come over to bomb probably Exeter, being chased by our fighters, dropped its bomb and went off. So, you know, it was just a chance.
What was your address at that time?
My address was Salisbury Avenue, 63 Salisbury Avenue. And it took down the corner of six houses, actually, which was just across the road from about as far as that bungalow there, 20 yards away. But it could have done a lot more damage, but the soil around there is very clay, and it was reckoned the bomb, instead of exploding on impact, it went into the ground, and of course it muffled a lot of the force of the explosion.
Did bombs fall in Penton and Brixham?
Oh yes, yeah. But once again, it was just a bomb here and there. There was never a concerted raid of any sort. It was just to upset the community as such, I suppose.
What kind of experience and training did you get in Sea Cadets?
Seamanship. Once again, I was always interested in wireless telegraphy. Even before I joined the Sea Cadets, I'd learnt the Morse code. And I used to concentrate on that as much as I could. But Basically, it was seamanship and drill.
Can you tell me about joining the Navy, please?
Yes, I joined the Navy in September 1945, when the boys' training establishment was then on the Isle of Man. I joined as a boy seaman, but then after a period of a couple of weeks, you had a choice, depending on how you did well in an exam, of changing over to the communications department. So I changed over to the communications department and trained as a wireless operator. The boys' training establishment on the Isle of Man closed down in Christmas 1945, when after Christmas leave we all went to HMS Ganges at Harwich, which was always a boys' training establishment. Certainly before the war, but during the war they decided to move it to the Isle of Man. So I stayed at the HMS Ganges until February 1947.
Any incidents that happened to you either on Isle of Man or at Shotley?
No, nothing that stands in my mind. No, it's quite. It was a harsh regime, the boys' training, but nothing untoward.
What did you think of the quality of the training that you got?
Well, it was always said that if the commander of a ship had the option of having a boy Ganges trained rather than someone else, they'd always go for the Ganges trained. It was they always had this reputation as being the best there was. In training, that is. I mean, the actual training. The training was hard, but they turned out good recruits.
Did you resent the harshness of the training?
Not really, no. It never really bothered me. It was tough, but we were young, and a lot of it just rolled off our backs.
And after Ganges?
I left Ganges in March 47, reported to the barracks at Devonport. They sent me on leave with a fortnight's rations and said, if you don't hear from us within a fortnight, don't just hang on, stay there. So, lo and behold, they didn't ask me to go back until May, so I was on leave for 3.5 months waiting for a ship. The longest leave I've ever had, and being paid for it. And then I joined the Norfolk, a county class cruiser, for a 2.5 year commission in the East Indies. So I went out on the Norfolk as a boy telegraphist, but within a couple of weeks I'd reached the age of 18 when I came out of the boys' mess and went in with the big boys, as an ordinary tell. So I did travel quite extensively on the East Indies station, but in September 48, all the original boy tells, and there were six of them on the Norfolk, were drafted to ships in the Far East. We were in Singapore at the time. Four of the original boy tells went on to the Black Swan, and myself and another tell, Derek Cook, were drafted to the Amethyst.
Before we leave the Norfolk, what were living conditions like in that ship?
Well, it was rat infested, to be quite honestly. I've never been on a ship that it was ridden with rats. And most of them came on board, so it was said, while we were in Bombay. In fact, our mess was shut down on one occasion, everything cleared out, and some gas pellets of some sort were placed in the mess to try and kill these rats who just crawled away and died. At one stage, the navigator was offering 5 cigarettes for each rat tail that was produced. And there were so many being found, he knocked it down to 3 cigarettes for each tail. It was terrible. I used to see them running. If you went on the middle watch, or your watch during the night, we were sleeping in hammocks, of course, you had to lash your hammock up. Instead of, normally you jump out of your hammock, go on watch, and come back and jump in it again. But if you did that, there'd probably be a rat crawling around in it. So. But she was an old ship, and I think this was her last commission anyway. But it wasn't very pleasant at all.
What food were they getting hold of?
I don't know. I don't know. Anything was left lying around. And we had the usual trove of cockroaches, of course. But once again, a lot of it was because she was an old ship. Any other ship that I went on was in no trouble like that.
What was the cockroach trouble?
Well, they used to get it in a bread locker in the main. We used to have a locker which would keep our bread in. And you'd open that up and first thing in the morning or during the night. It was, we'd never seemed to be able to get on top of it. Never really clear this vermin.
Did the rats or cockroaches cause any problem to the men?
Not that I was aware of, no. It's surprising, really, when you come to think of it.
Was that the Norfolk a happy ship for you?
Oh, yes, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it, yes, and we went to some great places, the Gulf, and Mauritius, the Seychelles, ports in East Africa, Dar es Salaam, Zanzibar. I really enjoyed it. But that was my first big ship and my last big ship. From then on, I seemed to pick up all small ships.
How did you feel then about leaving Norfolk to go to Amethyst?
I can't say. In fact, I was looking forward to it. In the East Indies, we extended as far as Singapore. Now, I was going on a ship which was further east, so I was going to get around and see more places. So I was quite looking forward to it, actually. I wasn't prepared for a small ship. I mean, the life on a small ship is, very different to big ships, the routine and what have you. But no, I was looking forward to it and I enjoyed it, quite honestly.
Which routine did you prefer, in cruisers or in destroyers?
The small ship. It's much more relaxed.
Amethyst wasn't actually a destroyer.
Well, no, it was originally a sloop, but then it was reclassified as a frigate.
What's the difference?
I don't really know what the difference is. I mean, they certainly didn't alter the structure of it, so as a frigate, it didn't look any different to a sloop. For some reason, they phased out the word sloop.
And living conditions in Amethyst as compared with Norfolk?
Much more crowded, but the routine was more relaxed.
Can you give an example?
Well, dress code for instance. I mean, of course, the Norfolk, which I probably should have mentioned, was the CNC's flagship of the East Indies. So the routine on there, if you were on the upper deck, you had to be in the right rig of the day and what have you. And of course, on occasions he had his family with him as well, or his wife, and it was restricted where you could go or what you could do. You do a lot of sunbathing and that could be restricted at times where you did it. But no, it's it's much more relaxed on a small ship. Plus the fact you get to know most people.
Can you tell me what happened next, please?
Well, I took passage on the Black Swan from Singapore to Hong Kong, where I picked up the Amethyst. And going from there, I think we did our first Malayan patrol. Funny enough, we went back to Singapore and Malaya and did some Malayan patrols during the Malayan problems. In the main, we would pick up some soldiers in Singapore, take them up to up the east coast patrol we were on, drop them off, they disappear into the jungle and we never saw them again. On another occasion, we'd send a party ashore to service wireless stations. There were some of the outposts up there with the police and mainly the police. And just generally patrol up and down. Never saw any trouble or any bother. They'd send the odd party ashore for some reason or other with a wireless set, but we never saw any trouble. We did two Malayan patrols, and some years later, about 5 years ago, I was talking to the chap who transferred on from the Norfolk to the Amethyst with me, talking about the Amethyst medal, and he mentioned he had a Malayan bar to his medal. And I said, well, I don't understand that because I haven't got one. And I've been with him for the full 2.5 years, so wherever he'd gone, I'd gone with him. I wrote off to the naval authorities in Portsmouth, mentioning what had happened, and thought that if he's in touch to it, I thought I would have been in touch to it. They sent me an acknowledgement to say that it was being looked into, but it could take some considerable time. I put this card in my drawer, forgot all about it, and about 18 months later, I had a letter from Portsmouth to say that I was entitled to the Malayan bar. Now, this is about 40 years after I should have had it. So that went on with the Yangtze medal.
Any incidents that happened when you were operating during the emergency in Malaya?
None at all, really. No, basically we just used to take people up, mainly, I thought they were Gurkhas, but someone else said they were a Malayan regiment. But we should just drop them off, a couple of trips, drop them off and just generally cruise up and down. But I can't remember anything happening at all, to be quite honest. And we did two of those patrols. I think the last one was in just before we went up to the... Yes. One interesting fact is that I qualified, well, not only me, but others on board, qualified for the Yangtze medal on April the 20th, 1949. But then I found out that 6 weeks prior to that, I qualified for the Malayan medal. So in actual fact, we qualified for two general service medals within a period of 6 weeks, which is, I should think, is not too common. But No, it was just quite a quiet patrol, actually. No problems. A bit more work to be done as regards to wireless traffic. They said the odd planes flying around, which we used to have to keep in touch with. But basically, it was quite enjoyable, really. Lovely beaches up there for swimming on the east coast.
And then?
Then we went back to Hong Kong, getting ready for a cruise to Japan. I was looking forward to going there. I'd never been to Japan, and I haven't been yet. But oh no, I'm going back. We went back to Hong Kong and did a trip to Nanking, the Yangtze Patrol. They were keeping a guard ship up at Nanking at that time, ready to evacuate anybody from the British Embassy and to take stores up. This was while the communists were getting near to crossing the Yangtze. Now, that was in the end of 1948. we relieved the guard ship at Nanking, stayed there for about 4 weeks, I think. We took up a load of supplies, and we brought back quite a few civilians from the British contingent in Nanking. Went back to Shanghai, where unfortunately the port was in the grip of a yellow fever. So we spent Christmas in Shanghai swinging around the buoy, no shore leave. Well, then the new year we spent on the way to Hong Kong, to go back to Hong Kong, where we were getting ready to go for a trip with the fleet to Japan. The guard ship that was due to go up at that time was an Australian ship called the Shoalhaven, but the Australian government said that they wouldn't send the ship up there because of the general condition of the country. The communists were getting near to the northern banks of the Yangtze then, getting ready to cross it, and they refused to send the ship up there. So we were the what they call the canteen boat. I don't know if you've heard of the flotilla.
We were the
junior boat, the junior ship, I should say, of the flotilla. So they had to find another ship to go to take a place in the Shoalhaven, which they gave to the Amethyst. We were the junior ship, and that was one of the, not a perk, the perk. So they decided to send us up. So in April 1949, we set off for Shanghai, picked up our stores and what have you from Shanghai, and made our way up to the Yangtze for our second trip. Things were ready for anything untoward. With the ensign painted on the quarter deck and large flags to unfurl over the sides of the ship to identify ourselves. More identification, I should say. I mean, it was obvious we were a British ship, but we weren't really expecting any trouble. We anchored overnight about 100 miles up the Yangtze. I can't remember the name of the place. And then set off again the next morning, the morning of the 20th. Now, I was on the forenoon watch on that day, from 8 o'clock in the morning till 12:30. We were underway. I, in actual fact, relieved Jack French, who had done the morning watch. If I could explain, it was a small ship, so we didn't have a very big complement of wireless operators. There was a petty officer, a leading telegraphist, and three telegraphists, of which I was one of the telegraphists. And we used to just have one telegraphist on watch at a time to do the actual transmission of messages. During the day, of course, the PO and the leading hand were always around, but during the nights, there was just the one telegraphist on duty. So I leave Jack French, and we were underway by this time. And then about 8:30, we had some small arms fire. It had come from the northern bank where the communists were. A signal was sent to, I was on watch, I was sending the signals at this stage. A signal was sent to Hong Kong or Singapore, I forget which was, to this effect. But it just fizzled out. You know, no, just thought one of these things. This was about 8:30, and then about, I think it must have been about an hour late, about 9:30, they just opened up. Now, we were fortunate in effect that the awareness office was on the port side of the ship. We were going up to Nanking, and the communists on the northern bank were on the starboard side. Now, when I come to think of it, one of the first salvos hit the warehouse and the bridge, which this caused most of the damage and knocked the steering out. Now, the warehouse and the bridge is right above the wireless office. But because the wireless office was on the port side, it didn't touch us. We heard, of course, but no damage. Now, if the wireless office had been on the other side of the ship, there's no doubt that all communications would have gone there and then. But in actual fact, we were able to send a message to say that we'd been hit and was under fire, and gave our position. Now, as I said, if we'd been on the other, if the wireless had been on the other side of the ship, we probably wouldn't have got that message away. Although there's no doubt they the authorities would have known where we were, because they knew where we'd anchored and when we were, but they wouldn't have known what had happened, not at that stage. So fortunately, we were able to get that message away. But and then, cut a long story short, eventually...
No, don't cut the long story short, just get the details, please.
So we sent this message, but when they worked out the position in Hong Kong, it put us, I don't know how many miles inland. Now, either in the confusion, the position was written down wrong from the navigator, or I could have sent it. I could have made a mistake in sending it, or there could have been a mistake in receiving it. But either way, it put us inland. But they knew roughly where we were anyway. And then, well, the next thing I can remember was there was a first lieutenant coming into the wireless office, because all the bridge was out of action. The wheelhouse, the shell had hit the wheelhouse, jammed the steering, and just turned us to port. No steering at all, and this is where we went aground. On one of the mud banks, or rather than the sand banks, I suppose it was. So we were just a sitting target, still being shelled. Certainly, I think that our forward guns, couldn't fire because they couldn't bear. So basically, all we had left was small arms fire, because one of the other turrets had been hit. So we were just sitting there, being shelled. I remember the first lieutenant coming into the office, very badly wounded. Using the wireless office as the control office, I suppose, to put it bluntly, while everything else had gone on outside. And then the power just went off. Another shell had hit the power room, and all the power went off. So we were out of touch with the world. But the consort, the ship we were going to relieve, had picked up the signal, or had been given the details anyway, from Hong Kong. So everybody knew where we were, roughly what had happened. because we were able to send a signal to say we were aground and suffered heavy casualties. So from then on, it was a case of, what do we do? It was laughable, really. Dishing out rifles and Bren guns to repel boarders, which is a bit, when you think of it, against the might of the Communist Army, if they should come. In actual fact, they didn't cross the river until dark. But then it was a case of, what do we do? Preparing ourselves for if we should get boarded.